Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program visits the Cumberland Club in Portland for their Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series. The speaker is Professor Paul Andrew Mayevsky, a renowned climate change scientist and explorer, who has led more than 50 expeditions to remote areas of the world such as Greenland, Antarctica, and the Himalayas. His talk will center around abrupt changes in the Earth's atmosphere, as documented through his research and analysis of ice core data. If you enjoy this program and wish to hear it again, or perhaps to share it with a friend, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. You'll also find a video slideshow of the professor's PowerPoint presentation, which he'll refer to during the speech. A service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Brenda Garand, Cumberland Club board member and president of Garand.
Hello, I am Brenda Garand, and I'm a member of the board here at the Cumberland Club, and I'd like to thank all of you so much for being with us this evening. This is going to be a very exciting presentation because I'm so proud and pleased to introduce you to Professor Paul Andrew Mayevsky, who's here from the University of Maine. Paul is the head of the Climate Change Institute at the university and is just back from Chile, where he was working in his research capacity as an ice core specialist. We are very fortunate to have Dr. Mayevsky with us this evening, since he is among the most renowned scientists in the climate change arena. And some of what you'll learn this evening, I think you'll find particularly interesting, given the fact that our discussions as a culture around the issue of climate change have focused almost exclusively on the notion of global warming. What you'll see this evening is a very interesting story and a lot of compelling evidence that shows the interesting combination of global events together with man-made events that have created an almost inescapable acceleration in climate change. Dr. Mayevsky has been the number one appearing guest on programs like NOVA and 60 Minutes, and his program at the University of Maine is world-renowned for its scholarship and for its contribution to this important course of information that I know is both topical and of interest to all of you. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Mayevsky.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation to come to the club. It's a beautiful place, as all of you know. Today is actually a very important day for Maine and also for polar research. Today, you may have heard on the radio, is the 101st, today actually, 101st anniversary of Admiral Peary's trip to the pole, the very first trip to the North Pole. And he's not actually the first in a long line of Mainers, people related to Maine, obviously many whalers, who have spent a great deal of time in the polar regions. He was followed by Donald McMillan, who, of course, was the captain of the Bowdoin and went to Greenland about 35 times. So Maine really has a very long history of being involved in the polar regions, and if you go anywhere in the state, it's easy enough to bump into people who've worked in the Antarctic and Greenland and all over. I started working, so that was 101 years ago. I started working in the Antarctic in 1968. And between 1968 and the 1970s, which I like to call the early days, because in fact, at that point, scientific research in Antarctica had only gone on for really about 10 or 20 years. We had a completely different view of what the Antarctic, what Greenland was like, and for that matter, what any remote part of the planet was like. And the belief was, and for good reason, and we believed it literally until the 1980s and definitely until the 1990s, was that all of these very remote places were completely separated from the rest of the planet. What happened there sort of stayed there, like Las Vegas, I guess, all the advertisements. And in fact, they never changed. And I would bring rocks back from Antarctica, some of which are in the Boston Museum of Science, that had taken millions of years to be sculptured. And the impression that we all got was that this was an absolutely unchangeable place that had absolutely nothing to do with what happens to us today. It turns out to be a little less than a month ago. We were at a little bit over 19,000 feet. My team and I, one other faculty member and several graduate students, and we were in the process of visiting yet another ice mass, this particular one in the Andes. And the reason that we went there was we have been putting together, basically for the last 40 years, a global array of what will turn out to be ice cores, which I will explain. And the purpose of these is to provide perspective. And that's the key word, is perspective. And these records provide you with a perspective that you cannot really get any other way. And that perspective is really based on this piece of information. This is the temperature of the northern hemisphere in red and the southern hemisphere in blue, going from about 1880 up to the present. And that is, for all purposes, the longest continuous sort of well-trusted record that we have of temperature on the planet. And, of course, it shows you that there have been periods when it's been cooler, periods when it's been warmer, a gradual trend upward, but nevertheless, those cold periods. And since that record is only a little bit over 100 years long, one can certainly question what happened before it and what's going to happen in the future. The fact that now may be, and is, in fact, the warmest time period, our decade and the last decade of the last 120, 130 years, might not be enough to convince people that anything in particular is happening. So the question is, has the world always operated this way? Well, number one, these records are really only temperature records. We do have precipitation records that semi-parallel these, but after that, we really don't have any other records. And the climate is not just temperature. It's not just precipitation. It's understanding changes in storm patterns, and it's also understanding changes in the chemistry of the atmosphere. How high were greenhouse gas levels in the past? How high were toxic metal levels? How much dust was in the atmosphere? These are all part of the climate system. So what we would really like to be able to do is to reconstruct over our planet information that allows us to determine the physical and chemical changes in the climate system. And we want to know when they happened, why they happened, where they happened, and how much they happened in order to provide the perspective that we need to understand this increasing trend with a few cold periods in the last 120 years. And these are the records that we use. 20 years ago, I almost had to pay people to go and talk about these things and had to explain what they are, but I think most likely everybody is at least familiar. These are just silly cylinders of ice that we drill from glaciers all over the world. I'll show you very quickly where we work. But they are remarkable records. We can date them right down to the season. And in fact, we're now working on a new technique that will allow us to date right down to the storm level. We will soon be able to collect as many as 100,000 measurements in about 3 feet of snow. 100,000, I should say 100,000 sample levels, and at each sample level, we will be able to measure between 50 and 100 different things which define the climate system. And when you take those 50 to 100 things and translate them into the sorts of things that we care about, they turn out to be using, they're not necessarily directly these, but we can relate them to these. They turn out to be temperature, precipitation, storm systems, atmospheric circulation, the extent of sea ice on the planet, biological productivity in the ocean versus how much biological productivity is on the land, which, of course, is related to warmth, but it's also related to humidity. It's related to the chemicals that are in the system, volcanic activity, forest fire activity, and changes in atmospheric chemistry, which are greenhouse gases and all the rest of these. We can also actually tell changes in the energy output of the sun. We can tell whether or not there have been lightning storms. And most recently, we've been working on the most recent extraterrestrial impact on the planet, which occurred about 12,900 years ago, which in a word was a real showstopper. We work all over the world. We work in the Arctic and Greenland. We work in Antarctica. We work in Tibet and the Himalayas. And we work in New Zealand, South America, and North America and the Pacific. Why do we work in these areas? Well, I'll go through them very, very quickly, but let me just give you some highlights. In Greenland, we drilled the deepest ice core record ever developed, and from that, we were able to go back 110,000 years year by year from which we are able to come up with all of these things. And I'll give you highlights of these in the remainder of the presentation. In Antarctica, I've run multi-national expeditions. These are multi-institutional expeditions. These are multinational expeditions, which we've organized 25 different countries in order to travel all over the Antarctic ice sheet, which is 1.5 times the size of the United States. And in the process, we had the first identification of the Chernobyl nuclear accident in the Southern Hemisphere. We've worked on the Antarctic ozone hole, greenhouse gases. We've been able to demonstrate that Antarctica is, in fact, very much linked, and you'll find out why, to the rest of the world. And in the process, I was able to actually cover more remote portions of Antarctica than any other, I like to say this, not human, any other creature on the planet. Because there's nothing else that is stupid enough to go all over Antarctica. But I've now traveled about 25,000 kilometers over the Antarctic ice sheet by ski, by snowmobile, and various other things. Not by penguin. In Asia, we've been working on things primarily related to water resources and health because half of the world's population lives in this region. We've worked on Mount Everest, come up at, not to the top, pretty high, within up to about 24,000 feet, two times from the south side, three times from the north side, drilled ice cores right down to the bottom, and worked all over the Nepalese, the Indian, and the Chinese Himalayas. And then in these regions, most recently we've come back from the Andes, but we've also worked in New Zealand. And one of the things we're particularly interested in, just to point out one, is drought. Australia has been in drought for the last 25 to 30 years, and it's only in the last couple of years that this collective program in Antarctica that I've been working on has actually come up with one of the answers for why, in fact, the drought may have occurred, why, and unfortunately why it probably will continue until about 2060 or 2070. It's directly related to the ozone hole and the changes in circulation produced by that. So, tons of different topics. I didn't even put acid rain up there. Many different topics and many different disciplines have been involved. And 350 students have been involved in this process. Never go in the field without at least one, more often 4 to 5 students. Now let's begin to focus in on the things which are probably the most important that we have gleaned over the last few decades. These are major advances in climate science. They've absolutely changed the way we think about climate science. They could not have been done if we didn't go back in time. And I don't want you to think that I'm the only person who does these sort of things. There are certainly many graduate students, faculty related, and there are other people in the world who do this sort of work too. But I'll focus primarily on the achievements that we've made. What we've done is to provide an unprecedented perspective. The first thing that we did, and I think probably the most important, I was in charge of a program in the late 1980s, and we were given by Congress $25 million, which is a lot of money now, but it was particularly a lot of money then. I was dragged into the director of National Science Foundation and told, you have an awful lot of money. You better come up with something important, otherwise you and your field are out of business. So we came up with something that I think, I know it's very important, and I hope you'll agree. It's not just the concept, but it's the proof that the climate system operates very quickly and that there are things called abrupt climate change events. Why is this important? If you look at that 120-year-long record, there's been a gradual rise, but everything happens relatively smoothly. And our understanding of the climate system, largely from other tools like marine sediments in which you capture a few hundred years at a time, was that climate changes very, very slowly. Now, that may not seem like an important concept, but it really is, because underpinning that concept, if you believe that the climate system operates slowly, taking thousands of years to respond, that means that no matter what we do to the planet, it doesn't really matter. It'll just be sort of dissipated in the soup that will take thousands of years to emerge. What we found out was that the climate system can change very quickly. It can change in less than 1 to 2 years. And very dramatically. In some cases, temperature can change by as much as 15 degrees centigrade. There are times in the past, and fairly regularly, and when those very dramatic changes of 15 degrees centigrade occur, they get locked into either significantly colder or significantly warmer periods, in, for example, the North Atlantic, that can last for a few hundred years, and then it goes away just as fast. So all of a sudden now we've managed in 1 year with an awful lot of work and prior to that and European colleagues and comparisons with colleagues, we managed to demonstrate that the atmosphere is capable of shifting dramatically in significantly less than a human lifetime, less than a political cycle, and absolutely changing the way we think. It's almost as if we were hit by a meteorite that didn't necessarily destroy us, but really changed our world, up or down. At the same time, you can have dramatic changes in storm patterns, atmospheric circulation, dramatic changes in precipitation. A place, a city that was built in a particular part of the world might go from having enough water for agriculture to suddenly going into drought. And I'll show you an example of that. And the way that those atmospheric circulation systems seem to change is represented here. If you take a look at the northern hemisphere, obviously the United States, this lower blue line shows you the winter position of the jet stream, the edge of the cold polar air masses. Sometimes this has a very different shape, but it generally goes pretty far south in the United States. And this is the summer position, which retreats farther to the north. So this is polar air moving farther south in the summer, and that's in the winter, and being farther north in the summer. So imagine an abrupt climate change hitting us, and it would be the equivalent of having the summer system suddenly locked into the winter system for most of the year, plummeting Maine from whatever 3 or 4 months of winter that we have, maybe to 11 months of winter, and staying that way for many decades, if not many hundreds of years. Or the other way around, which is actually just as terrifying, too. We also know that at the same time, for some of these events, but not all of these events, the ocean actually changes its circulation time. And the ocean its circulation is driven by the rotation of the Earth, by where the planets are, but in particular by how much cold water goes into the ocean, because cold water is very dense. So in a place like the Antarctic, anything that melts off the Antarctic makes its way into that blue lower limb of the ocean. And actually, any place that we go in the ocean, you go into the Gulf of Maine, and in the very lower parts of the Gulf of Maine, you will probably find a chemical signature that tells you that water came from Antarctica because it's so dense. And in this particular part of the world, the density changes are more related to salinity. And I won't go into the details, but by changing the salinity of the ocean in the North Atlantic and changing the amount of cold water that goes in from the Antarctic, you can actually change ocean circulation. And some of these abrupt change events are related to that ocean circulation. Some of them are not. Now, in the next slide, I have the proof that abrupt climate change is real. It's real because Hollywood says it's real. I just watched this last night, actually. This is The Day After Tomorrow, which is a great movie. And this is Waterworld. And these are the two extremes of climate change. And while everybody was concerned that the jet stream would move into its winter position for the next several hundred years, I can guarantee you that we won't see this and we won't see that. There isn't enough water on the planet to actually cover the whole planet, but there's enough to actually raise sea level about 300 feet if you melted all of the ice on the planet. It's not going to happen. We will not lose all of the Antarctic, but I'll tell you near the end of the presentation how much we probably will lose in the next 100 years. So we're in the middle someplace, which ought to make you feel a lot better, maybe. So these abrupt climate change events, it turns out that when North America and Europe were covered by a lot of ice, which was a little bit more than 13,000, 14,000 years ago, the events were much, much bigger than they are today. And today they're relatively small, and you couldn't tell that from the way I've portrayed this. But imagine that signal was magnified 10 or 15 times. That's what those events used to look like. Today, in the last 10,000 years, which is an important time because that's a time during which civilization has emerged, and the time period that we, of course, in which the climate looked more or less the way it does today, there have been a lot of variations. This is not temperature. This is actually the amount of sea ice in the North Atlantic. And the North Atlantic is particularly important in the abrupt climate change story, unfortunately for us, because what we do know by now finding these events all over the world is that the North Atlantic tends to be the area where these are most magnified. So that Eastern North America and Western Europe, if we experience another abrupt climate change event, and if the past is any key to the future, we will see a more dramatic expression of this thing. But if you were to translate these into temperature, these are relatively small. In terms of temperature, they'd be maybe a couple of degrees centigrade, which doesn't sound like very much. But these are not really temperature as much as they are the length of winter and the length of summer. And what this record says is that times during which there was very little sea ice in the North Atlantic are the low ones. Times when there was a lot of sea ice in the North Atlantic are the high ones. So the low ones mean that it's more summer-like conditions. And 4,200 years ago, exactly, because this record can be dated year by year, going back 110,000 years, never done before, actually never done since, unfortunately, as much as we try. And places like ancient Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Syria, experienced 4,200 years ago. I love really bad movies, or not bad. I like adventure movies. So the last Raiders of the Lost Ark, this is Petra, and they were leaving Petra. And Petra, nobody lives in Petra now. Why don't they live in Petra? Because turns out that the summer-like conditions in the North Atlantic... The lack of sea ice in the North Atlantic made it more summer-like, and the summer is the period of drought. And if you make the summers longer in the North Atlantic and make them longer in the Middle East, there's not enough water. And in Petra, they built their city in the wrong place by only a few tens of kilometers, but it's enough. Another place in which that was impacted greatly by an extension of the summer season was Mayan civilization. Its final collapse, and actually even the other collapses that occurred, the minor collapses before that, relate directly to times when the summer in the North Atlantic was longer, and therefore the air masses that came into Central America were dry because they get their moisture, as does the Middle East, primarily in the winter. Now, there's a very important take-home message from these two. This is the Middle East, and this is Central America, and as the climate warms, they are plunged into drought, and the climate is, in fact, warming, and all of the models suggest that that warming will, in fact, impact these areas again. And, of course, it will be the Western world that will be blamed largely for this if, in fact, as I believe it is related to greenhouse gases. Let's look at the opposite. It's a time when the sea ice levels were very sea ice extent was very great in the North Atlantic. And at that particular time, there were colonies in Greenland, Norse colonies. They had gone to Greenland in about AD 1000 when conditions were much milder. And when they established cities, that's one of the cathedrals that they built in the coast of Greenland. Within the next 400 years, there was a long debate with the archaeological and anthropological community that these people had been wiped out by the Inuits, but the Inuits didn't wipe them out. It turns out that they were wiped out by climate. They required yearly or close to yearly resupplies by vessels, which they were unable to get, and they disappeared. So these are small compared to the ones more than 15,000 years ago. And I'm not suggesting that the ones we're going to have in the future will, in fact, even be like the ones 15,000 years ago, but these were enough to dramatically impact people. Now, you may say, well, Maine, we don't live close to a drought area, and we're not surrounded by sea ice, but one thing that really does greatly impact us is precipitation and storm patterns. Anybody who's tried to fly for business meetings in the last few years is getting harder and harder to get on a plane and go places. So without a doubt, everybody lives in a place that eventually will be impacted. The other thing we've contributed to, this is a very controversial record. This is the so-called hockey stick, which was attacked. But the hockey stick is made up of many, many different records. And the person who was attacked was a contributor to just one of these records. And the ice core records that we've produced have been input into this. And what you can see is that in the last 1,100 years, this is 900 AD right up to the present, we have experienced in the last few decades the warmest temperatures of the last 1,100 years. And you could look at that and you could say, wow, I mean, Earth history is much longer than that. Maybe that's not significant. And there were times on the planet when it was much, much warmer millions of years ago, which actually was a time when greenhouse gases were significantly higher than today. We've also found places in, for example, Antarctica. This is a record. It's compressed logarithmically, but this is a record that goes from 100,000 years to 10,000 to today, zero, and we find the highest temperatures in this part of Antarctica in the last couple of decades that have occurred in the last 100,000 years. This is only one record. There are others similar to it. But in general, you can find many, many different ways of demonstrating that what we are experiencing today with temperature is, in fact, unique. The melting of glaciers all over the planet. In some cases, as those glaciers melt, they've actually unearthed, in the process of retreating, organic material, which can be dated. And you can see that that glacier, the last time that that glacier covered organic material was 5 or 10,000 years ago. So without a doubt, in the last couple of thousand, potentially 5,000, and in some parts of the world, 100,000 years, we're experiencing temperatures that we have not experienced in the past. So I've been talking about ice a lot because ice, of course, is the place that we get our records. But the other thing that we do as an institute in particular, is to monitor changes in the extent of ice and try to understand what the dynamics of the ice masses are. And why do we do that? Because, of course, as the climate begins to warm, the place that's going to be impacted first are going to be the cold places. If we walked into this room and the temperature was 0 degrees centigrade and or minus 1 degree centigrade, we all walked in with a little glass of ice. By the end of the presentation, if the temperature rose a degree or something a little bit more than that centigrade, it would melt. So the places that are the most obvious to look for change are going to be those places that are currently covered by ice. And these are the two polar regions. Obviously, the North Polar region and the South Polar region, tremendous differences in geography, which, in fact, are the reason why we're seeing the sequence of melting that we are. Northern Hemisphere, primarily continents, surrounding an Arctic Ocean, and in the center, that Arctic Ocean has only a couple of meters of sea ice in it. So that's relatively easy to melt. When it melts, it releases a great amount of heat. Southern Hemisphere is a continent surrounded by ocean. Average size of that continent is 1.5 times the size of the United States, and the average thickness of the ice is 6,000 feet. So it takes a long time, even if it were very, very warm, to melt that. And the center of this continent, which we've gone through many times, the mean annual temperature ranges between minus 50 and minus 70 degrees centigrade. So even a 10 degree centigrade rise in temperature isn't going to melt that. But the edges are going to be greatly impacted. And as this melting occurs and occurs in the rest of the planet, tons of things will start to change. Number one, 80% of the fresh water on the planet is tied up in these glaciers, which means that it can eventually get into the ocean, change the salinity of the ocean, and change the temperature of the ocean, which changes the turnover time. Sea level can rise 65 meters. These are the largest solar reflectors on the planet. And when the sea ice surrounds Antarctica, you can see this is the maximum extent. It doubles the size of Antarctica in the winter. And when it is this white, it reflects tremendous amount of radiation. And when the sea ice contracts, either seasonally or as it begins to shrink, which it will eventually start doing with warming, it will change the color of the ocean from white to dark. The darker it is, the more heat is absorbed. And that's actually, in many ways, a good thing, because the Southern Ocean is a great absorber of heat and is one of the biggest buffers that we have right now that is actually preventing us from feeling the full brunt of the warming. Tremendous biological activity in a whole, and also the largest desert in the world is in Antarctica, because in the center of Antarctica, the amount of snow that's accumulated is about this much. So all of the extremes, literally, almost all the extremes, are in Antarctica. So what's one of the prime causes of this thing? Without a doubt, there is an awful lot of natural variability in the climate system. And we always are studying natural climate variability because we're looking at very long records. And we understand what the various controls are on the long-term climate variability. Some of them operate on the order of 10,000, some operate on the order of decades, like the sunspot cycle. And we have a reasonably good understanding of these things. But if we look at the impact of greenhouse gases, what we find out, of course, is that this is the composition of the atmosphere: nitrogen 76%, oxygen 21%, and greenhouse gases make up less than 1%, which is why they're so important, why it's so easy to affect or to impact them by human activity. But the other property they have, of course, is they allow heat to come in but not to go out. Greenhouse effect. Of these, carbon dioxide is only 3% of the less than 1% in the atmosphere. Because it's so small, that means that humans can dramatically impact it. And if we take a look at what has happened, I should have explained, sorry, this is a record that goes back 400,000 years, but I could have taken it back 850,000 years. It comes from an ice core in Antarctica, and this red thing shows you temperature. Up is warm, down is cold. This is methane, also actually a more important greenhouse gas than CO2 and emerging as an even more important one, and that's CO2. And the take-home story is, of course, that temperature goes up and the greenhouse gases go up. In truth, it's not that simple a story, even though you might be led to believe that by watching some public displays of this. Sometimes the greenhouse gases actually rise after the temperature, and that's very important to remember. But at the very least, we know that no matter what makes that greenhouse gas rise, it may not always trigger a temperature rise, but what it does do is sustain that temperature rise or sustain the temperature lowering. So again, whenever temperature goes up, the greenhouse gases go up, they at least sustain the rise in temperature. So what's the big deal about greenhouse gas rising today? This is 400,000 years, and this is a blow-up of the last 100 years that I have the red box around. And if you take a look at what's happened to CO2 and methane, CO2 today is 30% higher than it has ever been in the past 850,000 years. And methane is two times higher than it has ever been in the last 850,000 years. And even that might not necessarily knock you over, but what ought to knock you over is the fact that the CO2 levels have risen 100 times faster than they ever have before. And in fact, the Earth system is not capable of even responding that fast. But we do know that no matter why the temperature has risen in the past, it has been sustained, without a doubt. There is nothing else that we can use to explain sustaining those temperatures. So the question is, why is the temperature lagging? Because if you look at this more carefully, here's 100 times rise in CO2. Here's a 30% rise over anything in the last 850,000 years. Here's a two times rise in methane, and there's the change in temperature. It's only changed 1 degree centigrade in the last 100 years. Why? You would think that it would have changed much faster. One of the reasons, of course, is there is natural climate variability in the system. The other is that, in particular, the Southern Ocean, but the world oceans themselves, are capable of sustaining, of absorbing a great deal of this heat. And in fact, if you read Nature and Science and all of the top flight journals in these fields, you find every week somebody says, oh, the Southern Ocean it's reached its capacity. And once it reaches its capacity, which it will in not too many years, what will happen is the atmosphere will begin to heat much faster. But there is something else which I find actually even more intriguing, and it's us. We're part of the reason that the rise in temperature has not been as fast as it might be expected to be, or as responsive, but it nevertheless will happen. And in fact, we've not only done something to reduce it, we've done something to increase it. And the thing that I point to is some work that we did in the mid-'80s when we were involved in a completely different problem than global warming. We were involved in the acid rain problem. And we were supported by EPA, who actually built our laboratory for us, to be able to demonstrate whether or not the remote atmosphere was in fact impacted by sulfur and nitrogen, the two components of acid rain. The one that's most important is the red one, that's sulfur in the atmosphere. You see this goes back to the year 1000 up to the present. These spikes are volcanoes, and we know that every single time there's a rise in the volcano, that there's a cooling in temperature. And if you take a look at this rise in the last 100 years, that's because of anthropogenic activity. That's because basically around 1900, in the northern hemisphere, we pretty much turned on the industrial spigots, started spewing out tremendous amounts of sulfur from coal that was rich in sulfur, and the net result was a sustained volcano that lasted the equivalent of a sustained volcano for 100 years and cooled the atmosphere. Well, it wasn't quite 100 years. The depression is in here, and in fact, when the depression occurs, the levels of sulfur go down, and what happens when the levels of sulfur go down, the temperature rises a little bit, and inversely. So we have been able to offset for a while, because the greenhouse gas levels, remember, are beginning to rise through this period. We have been able to offset it and even cool it for a while. And then, of course, the Clean Air Act came along, which is a phenomenal thing. In fact, much of our research was used to renegotiate the next Clean Air Act. But that Clean Air Act cleaned up the air to some degree from one but not all, because there is also carbon in the atmosphere. There's dust in the atmosphere. But it cleaned up from the North Atlantic, one of the things that cooled off the atmosphere. And sure enough, when the Clean Air Act came in the late 1970s, the temperatures really began to rise as of 1980. Now, that's a good thing. I mean, we actually were able to alter something that we were doing wrong. And I would never advocate the fact that we should have more acid rain in order to counter greenhouse gas warming, but just to show you how sensitive the system actually is. So on this this plot goes back, the scale's a little bit small here, but this is today, and this goes back 5,000 years. The one on the top is population. This is CO2, nitrous oxide, which is another greenhouse gas, chlorofluorocarbons, which are humanly engineered chemicals, methane, a greenhouse gas, radioactivity, sulfur in the atmosphere, nitrogen in the atmosphere, copper and lead, which are nasty toxic metals, and mercury, which is also a nasty toxic metal. And, I mean, this diagram is hard enough to see the way it is, but I actually could have gone right down to the first floor with all of the things that I would like to show you in the following way. If you take a look at the last 5,000 years and then see what's happened in the last 100 years of these, every single thing, single one of these things has gone up. And if there is nothing else that you take home from this, if you don't believe in greenhouse gas warming, remember this. This is what we've done to the atmosphere. These are undeniable impacts of humans. I've only taken it back 5,000 years. We could go back a million years. We would never experience the increase in levels of toxic metals, humanly engineered chemicals, greenhouse gases, volatile organic compounds, ground level ozone. It goes on and on and on. And just to show you that this record doesn't lie, this is actually a log scale, so it makes it look a little bit higher. This is around 2,000 years ago, a tiny spike in copper and lead, and that tiny spike in copper and lead comes from the Roman and the Chinese smelting of iron. So you can't escape these records. If you did something bad or anything to the environment, we can tell. Now, most recently, we've been working on the Antarctic Peninsula, amongst a lot of other places, and on the Antarctic Peninsula, we recovered a record that it only goes back thus far to 1986. It'll eventually go back many hundreds of years, but it's a remarkable rise in uranium. In fact, there has been a 500 times increase in uranium in Antarctica, but actually the entire Southern Ocean, since 1986. And that comes directly from the largest Southern Hemisphere source of uranium, which happens to be almost number one in the world. It's just barely number two. It's 23% of all of the production of uranium in the world comes from one mine in eastern Australia, and the winds are blowing just in the right direction with the westerlies, and this stuff is being, this is the other side of the Southern Hemisphere, and we're still seeing a more than 500 times rise. I don't need to tell you that it's probably not good to take in uranium in your diet, but so the Southern Hemisphere, which has actually been relatively clean for a long time, is now beginning to show dramatic impacts. Why? It has very small population, very large ocean area to clean it up, and industrialization came there fairly late. So what have we created? We have created what I like to call a toxic cocktail. And it is a toxic cocktail for the following reasons. The warming, greenhouse gas warming, is producing vector-borne diseases. These are diseases that migrate because the temperatures rise, and it's easier for the host animals like Lyme tick, which now is suddenly got. I got to Maine only 10 years ago. I escaped from New Hampshire because New Hampshire suddenly, in the 25 years I lived there, they went from having no Lyme ticks to being infested, 60 a day on each of our dogs. And now it's happening in Maine, and that's because of the warming. It's great in some ways because the growing season is a little bit longer, but not for everything else. It also produces drought, floods, and storms, which you've heard a lot about. But also in this toxic cocktail are things like toxic metals, organic compounds, ground-level ozone, particulate matter that cause respiratory, neurological diseases, and cancer. And these things are all, some of them have been well legislated, like lead, but in fact the Chinese are still emitting lead, and we still get it in California because it comes across Asia. And then there's been tremendous ecosystem upheaval in the form of ocean acidification, drought, flood, et cetera. So without a doubt, we've created a very unique situation, and these are undeniable. There is no doubt that these things have changed. don't have to worry about whether or not one believes the models for the future or not. This is what has happened in the last 100 years. And the U.S. has been a leader in a lot of this legislation. We've been a leader in acid rain legislation, a leader in helping to repair the Antarctic ozone hole because of CFCs. We've been a leader in the reduction of lead. But there is much, much more to do. And we have produced unprecedented rates and changes. So in quick summary, just a couple of more slides here, an overview of where we go next. The model suggests that the temperature rise over the next century will be a minimum of 1.5 degrees to as much as 6 degrees. The likelihood is 3 degrees centigrade. For a place like the Antarctic, it has not been 3 degrees centigrade higher than it is today for about 20 million years. So that's dramatic right there. Human and ecosystem health, as I just demonstrated, has changed dramatically. Sea level, we know that a couple of small glaciers in Greenland, their melting alone is enough to explain 10% of the rise in sea level over the last 5 years, and they're just small glaciers. Once we begin to see the Antarctic really melting, we should expect, based on the most recent summary we've put out, we being 40 countries together, we should expect by 2100 a minimum of 1.4 meters of sea level rise, 5.5 feet. It could be more. But I think if you were building engineering restraints for high water levels, I'd build it to at least 2 meters. And these things are not necessarily going to happen linearly. We assume, based on the last 100 years, that the world operates linearly. But it won't necessarily. It could occur abruptly. There are tons of win-win solutions that we have available to us, and they're related to health, the economy, and security. And I won't go through the details, but clearly having a healthier environment, one that is economically more sound, and one that's more secure in terms of not using as much foreign oil, and in understanding what sort of storm catastrophes can impact us, is a much more, will improve dramatically our quality of life in the future. And all of these, some of these things we're going to have, without a doubt, we will have some warming. But some of these things, for example, respiratory disease produced by particles in the atmosphere, those things can be cleaned up in almost no time at all. During 9/11, when they shut the aircraft down, the atmosphere cleaned up dramatically. So how do we get there? We have a simple plan, and it includes not just talking about greenhouse gas warming, but really educating people about all of the other things that we've done in the last 100 years so that they are invested in the data, see what it is, making the science as transparent as possible, translating it, of course, into knowledge. They can look at the information themselves. Our goal is to set up systems in which they're able to look at these things. Get them involved and so that they actually have some ownership in this, so that they can begin to understand how much the planet has changed. And our ultimate goal is action. People can choose to become more active about increased levels of mercury, which they have already. And ultimately, if we're fortunate, social change. And this is part of a new initiative that the University of Maine and our institute is undertaking with Garand and also, or Garand. And we're actually, there are other partners too, but we're in the very initial stages. So I'll just mention these two. So it's been a great pleasure working with Brenda and her team. And our goal is to begin to translate this science, not just the science of greenhouse gas warming, but the science of all of these things so that people can actually understand it and come up with information. We hope by fall to have a launch of this new initiative, which we're going to call 10 Green. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miyevsky. How interesting and exciting for all of us to be here in Maine, where so much of this great science and analysis is happening. I have a few questions that I'd like to ask, and so let us proceed. The first is, for the novice, what do we need to know at a cocktail party?
Well, it depends if you want to depress people or if you want to encourage people.
I would vote for encouragement, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would too. And I think it's extremely important that, and I said that kidding, but it is very, very important. All of the things that we have done to the planet we did them because we all wanted the quality of life that we have, and it's wonderful. But beginning to turn these things around and beginning to repair them. And I include not just greenhouse gases, but all of the things that make our air and water quality less than what it should be. And that doesn't mean that it isn't dramatically cleaner than it was in the 1970s. In my mind, are really reasons for us to be very optimistic. The likelihood that over the next 20 to 30 years, a place like Maine will be not only a different place, but in fact probably a much more vibrant place with respect to jobs and possibilities for the future is very, very high. I believe that offshore wind is very, very important for us to undertake. I think there are the possibilities for having tremendous capability with that power for growing local organics. Maine could be a mecca for a whole series of cottage industries that can do everything from creating creative widgets and technology to creative ways in which we can conduct our lives so that we can not only help the planet but make ourselves healthier and save an awful lot of money in the process and improve the economy.
So what do you say to those who scoff at global warming and produce their own scientists who support their views?
There are some very bright skeptics out there. I've debated several of them, and I'd say the very big difference between the skeptics and the believers, for want of a better term, is the fact that in most cases the skeptics are taking information apart and only trying to prove that something is wrong, and it's much easier to do that. I actually have always thanked the skeptics because by taking the data apart, they've actually forced us to make this data much better. So they've done us a great service. Now we've actually emerged into a period in which the science is no longer really being debated, although that's what the media may suggest is being debated, but there's really much more of an attack on personalities and an attack on a very small number of people. And this is, in terms of ClimateGate, it was done very, very well.
The East Anglia.
Yeah, the East Anglia folks. It was done well. It was very timely. It was before Copenhagen. And when the opposing party, whether it's with respect to global warming or not, begin to attack individuals and maybe the way you do things and shy away from talking about the data, which is actually what they've done, you've gone away from the scientific debate. And this is a scientific issue. It needs to be solved by people and by politicians, but it is a scientific issue. And what we want to do is to make this data far more transparent to people and translate it to them. There are lawyers, business people out here, all sorts of architects, I'm sure. I mean, I don't have any idea what you do. You need to translate what you do to me, what you do. And that's the goal of scientists, and that's what we hope to do with 10 Green, is to create a situation in which this data becomes transparent to people and in which they can look at it for themselves and make their own decisions about whether or not they're happy with a world that has levels of lead which are 100 to 1,000 times higher than what we have in the natural atmosphere.
So here's a question about your curriculum at the University of Maine. Are you teaching undergraduates? Do they participate with you in your laboratories and in your research?
I actually started my entire program only with undergraduates, and it's emerged largely to graduate students now because, like everything else, the ante goes up. They need a background that usually requires a college courses, but they come from a whole variety of fields. We do involve a lot of undergraduates. We involve them for personal reasons, because we want to be able to take really good students and bring them into our program. This last summer, we had two students in Greenland with us, undergraduates who worked on the last and extraterrestrial impact 12,900 years ago. We have a lot of students working in the laboratories. And quite truthfully, we're very well supported by the government. If we had more money, we would actually be able to send more students in the field. These glaciers are melting really fast. And if we don't get out and sample them in the next 10 to 20 years, well, for one thing, I'm going to be too old to go there. But far more importantly, the glaciers will be gone from a lot of these places that we study. So we want to involve as many people as we can.
Do current environmentalist efforts, recycling, fuel-efficient vehicles, and so forth, matter? Can these mitigate large-scale climate change effects and trends?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a problem that this is not one of the, when you talk about climate change, if you're talking about greenhouse gas warming, it is hard to imagine that by changing the kind of car that you drive, you will actually be impacting the environment. Obviously, if you are one of millions of people who do that, yes, you will. But and that's what we need. And you make millions of people out of single people at a time. But also remember that along with those CO2 emissions come an awful lot of other things. There's a lot more coming out of your tailpipe than just CO2. There are nitrogen compounds coming out of there. There are carbon compounds. There's particulate matter. All of those things impact our health. So the more efficient your engine is, even if you don't care about warming, the better the chance that locally we will have a cleaner environment.
Here's a question from a budding scientist. What was it in the ice core that said Chernobyl occurred? Further, what was it in the core that said a monsoon occurred? Could you learn the equivalent of an ice core's story with a core of dirt?
That's a good question. You can learn a lot from dirt. And in fact, people do. I say that because it sounds funny, but in truth, people do. We have a fellow at the University of Maine, Ivan Fernandez, and he does tremendous amount of work with soils or dirt. We can learn an awful lot about local environments. We can learn whether or not there is human contamination in there. We can see whether or not the climate has changed. But if you want to go back year by year and actually look at things that might have happened over much larger areas, an ice core is the way to go. And the answer to Chernobyl is that we're able to identify all of the nuclear bomb events that have occurred on the planet by looking at ice cores. In fact, we use them, even though they decay over time, we use them as markers as we do volcanic events. And since the cessation of above-ground bomb atomic bomb testing, which I think was in the mid-1970s, there have been no radioactive spikes in the atmosphere. And Chernobyl is one of them, however. And in the case of a monsoon, just a very quick answer, the simple label for a monsoon is monsoons come from the ocean. The ocean has sea salt in it. So if you see a rise in sea salt in your ice core and you know exactly when it happened, and you're, for example, in the Himalayas, that means that that marine air masses, the monsoon, made its way into that region.
Please explain, if you would, your concept of abrupt climate change and what its implications are. Why was this so startling?
Well, abrupt climate change was startling because it completely diverted the thinking of the field of climate science. Up until our identification of abrupt climate change, there was a very big division probably between meteorologists who were studying day-to-day events, who were looking primarily at maybe the last 50 to 100 years of the climate record, who might be called climatologists, and then so-called paleoclimatologists. And the thinking was that what happened in the past certainly would be of interest to what would happen in the future, but there couldn't possibly be anything that happened so fast that we'd need to worry about it in the next several hundred years. And the identification of abrupt climate change completely changed that. And it not only got into Hollywood, but it's in the Pentagon, and there are plans in most countries for what would happen if we suddenly experienced a dramatic change. What, for example, would we do in Maine if we suddenly had an intensification of storms by five times? Five times the number of storms that we normally have, which is not that big a deal to change, and that lasted for, forget about 100 years. It even lasted for 5 years. What would that do? How long will the drought last in Australia? And the onset of that drought in Australia is a type of abrupt climate change. So these are not necessarily, they don't only have to be global things. Some of them are actually very local. If you happen to be in the wrong place, it's an abrupt climate change event for you. But it's a very different way of thinking about the way the climate system operates.
Well, here's a related question. Assuming human-generated greenhouse gases are significant contributors to climate change, can anything short of a retreat to pre-industrial revolution-like human behavior impact or slow change?
It's unrealistic to assume that we would ever go back to pre-anthropogenic levels of greenhouse gases. Even if we shut everything off today, it wouldn't happen, certainly in our lifetimes or many lifetimes in the future. I think we have to be realistic. We will always, certainly in the foreseeable future, emit greenhouse gases. The question is, how much can we take and what will the impact be? And there are some people who believe that we would get to a certain level, and then basically from there we fall off a cliff. There are others who believe that it might be a little bit more gradual. I think my belief is that if, in fact, there is a threshold over which we might go, that threshold won't necessarily have the same impact all over the world. To think that once we get to X number, the whole story is over, is a very potentially dangerous way to think, because this is the story of climate change and what humans have done to the climate system is not just about greenhouse gases. And if people begin to think that the poster child for climate change, changing it, has no impact at all, they really won't begin to look at these other things, which can be cleaned up in the very short term. So the bottom line is there are good health reasons, there are good economic reasons, and there are good security reasons for reducing all of these, even if you don't believe that the warming is going to come. I mean, the classic reason for reducing, purely from an economic and political point of view, the classic reason for reducing greenhouse gases is to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. In the early 1970s, the administration made a decision that we would no longer continue to elevate the efficiency of automobiles in terms of the mileage that they get, and it was actually downgraded. At that time, in the early 1970s, the U.S. produced almost as much oil as it needed for its consumption. Since the 1970s, we have departed. The amount we've needed versus the amount we've had to get from offshore is now close to 70%. And for that reason alone, it's a no-brainer. Why should we send our money all over the place and not have it for ourselves?
Thank you so much for this.
You've been listening to Professor Paul Andrew Majewski on Speaking in Maine. He spoke recently at the Cumberland Club in Portland as part of their Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. There, you'll also find a video slideshow of the professor's PowerPoint presentation, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.